It's wonderful to see our kids up here, isn't it? See those guys? They know that song pretty well. Good song to know, too, isn't it? For many years with our kids, one of my favorite activities was teaching the sixth grade Sunday school class on Sunday morning. So I did that many years, and I sort of got into a pattern with that. I would teach them about the life of Jesus going through the book of Luke in the spring. But for the fall and the winter, I started studying with them the book of Genesis. And I would just start in the first chapter of Genesis and just go with that story, kind of a chapter every week. It is an amazing story, and kids just lock in on it to hear those stories. And one of the more interesting parts of the story is about when you get to chapter 4, because they haven't really heard some of that stuff that's in chapter 4 there of Genesis. Of course, they've heard the first part about Cain and Abel. Here's the first man to be born on the world, into the earth, Cain, kills his own brother, Abel. And they understand sibling rivalry and anger with siblings, so they can identify with that. Remember that story that after Cain killed Abel, God told him that from that point on, he would be a wanderer on the face of the earth. He would be cast out from the relationship, close relationship with other human beings. And Cain said, "This is just more than I can take. It's more than I can bear. I'm going to walk around in fear all the time. And what's more, anybody who finds me is going to kill me." And God said, "No. Anyone who takes vengeance on Cain will have vengeance taken on them seven times over." Seven times over. It's an interesting thing there, isn't it? What is God saying? Is he saying this is going to be his punishment on anyone who would seek to do harm to Cain? Or is he saying that this is the way this goes? It just continues to multiply when people strike down, take vengeance on each other. Now then the end of that chapter, so the chapter kind of follows then this genealogy of Cain. It's very interesting, and it goes to the last character in that chapter is this great-great-grandson of Cain. And he has two wives, and he sits down one day with his wives, and he sings a little song to them. He says, "Listen to me, wives of Lamech," that's his name, "hear my words. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech will be avenged 77 times." What a guy, huh? The story leads right up to then this time of Noah, when you see these sons of Seth and these sons of Cain. And God says that the earth was corrupt in God's sight and full of violence. It's no surprise to you probably that from the very beginning, human history has been marked by these cycles of vengeance and violence and vengeance and violence. What causes this? Well, after hanging around with Jesus for a few years, as Chris read to us, Peter had gotten the message, hadn't he? That there was a way out of this violence and this vengeance that Jesus wanted us to practice, that God had a plan for us, and that was forgive. Forgive. But Peter still had a question. He said, "Now, are there limits to this forgiveness? How many times should I forgive? Up to seven times?" Now, before we criticize Peter too much, here's this number, seven. It indicates in the Bible often completeness. So Peter is heading in the right direction, isn't he? Can I look? Is there a fullness in this number of seven? Should I go even to seven times of forgiving those who sin against me? Jesus answers him. He says, "No, why don't you try this number? 77 times. Does that sound familiar, Lamech? Jesus takes the math of Cain, the way Cain figures things, and through his line, and totally reverses old Lamech's logic. Jesus says, "If you want to reduce forgiving to a numbers game, then here, try this number." And then, as he often does, he tells one of his little Bible stories. One of his little stories here. So there was this servant who owed 10,000 talents. And which sounds like a lot of money, doesn't it? I guess, what's a talent? But the king forgives his debt. Later, this forgiven servant finds another servant who owes 100 dinars. And that sounds like a little. But he wrings this guy's neck and has him thrown in the prison. Now, I asked my trusty accountant. I didn't know if you know this, but accountants will help you with this kind of stuff. And my accountant helped me figure out exactly how much money this would be in today's terms. And we looked at everything. We figured this one out. Okay, here's what she says. The second servant owes the first servant $12,000. 100 dinars. Today's terms, $12,000. Now, $12,000 is a good little bit of money, isn't it? You can start looking at a new car with $12,000, can't you? That's right. So it's no little bitty thing. It's no little thing. No wonder that first servant was upset. Now, the first guy's debt is 10,000 talents. A talent is not a coin. Okay, a talent is just a unit of money. It represents 15 years of wages for a working man at that time. So a talent's 15 years. And then Jesus says 10,000 talents. And the word he uses for 10,000 there is the highest number that he could articulate with two words in that language. And it's related to our word, myriad. He's saying it's myriad money. Countless talents. Myriad talents. So we kind of figured that up. The first guy's debt in today's money would be about $4.5 billion. $4.5 billion is what he owed. That's a pretty good bit of money. It's more money than was in circulation in the whole country of Israel and the whole provinces, all the provinces that Herod the Great ruled. It's more money than the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, could have gotten together to pay. And maybe a better translation of this, if Jesus was telling this to our kids here, he would say, this first guy owed a bazillion dollars, didn't he? Now the first servant tells the king, the one who owes the bazillion dollars, just imagine yourself hearing this from Jesus. The guy owes a bazillion dollars. And then the next words he says, and the first guy tells the king, now, if you'll have mercy on me, I'll pay you back everything I owe. How likely is that? He couldn't have paid back the king if he'd lived 100,000 lifetimes. Does he understand the magnitude of his debt? But even though the king must have understood, he didn't understand the magnitude of his debt, he forgives him anyway. He hands him forgiveness. He forgives every last penny of his debt, and he does it without a warning. He doesn't walk away from there shaming him. He doesn't say, now, go, you better do this. Or, do you understand exactly what I've done for you? He just forgives him. It's free. He walks out of there free. That's grace, isn't it? He gives him grace, full forgiveness. Now, if you'd been forgiven a bazillion dollars this past week, and you come and you sit here today, how would your heart feel? How would you sing these songs together? How would you hear these scriptures together? But that first servant, he leaves worship that morning. And he walks out through the parking lot, and he's still kind of, you know, whistling a tune from one of the hymns as he goes to get in his car. And he gets in his car, he starts to pull out of the parking lot, and he's going to go to his favorite place to eat lunch, and it's time to celebrate, isn't it? Look at what you've been forgiven. And all of a sudden, he remembers somebody that owes him something. So he swings his car in that direction, and he pulls up to this little house where he's got a renter staying in this house. And the guy's 6 months behind on his rent. And he pulls up there, and the guy comes out in his front yard, and there's his wife and his little kids with him right out there as well. And he calls the cops and he says, come and take this guy and throw him in jail. He's way behind. I've served him 3 times with court papers to pay his debt. He won't show up to the judge. And while they're putting the guy in the squad car, the first servant is going through his Rolodex, calling on his cell phone, get the water department, get the power department, and get those things shut off here to this house. I don't pay these things anymore. And he rolls down his window before he pulls off, and he says to the man's wife and children there standing in the yard, you'll get your daddy back when he pays me everything he owes me. That's the force of this story. 10,000 talents. How do you rack up that kind of bill? Have you thought about that? How do you rack that up? Now, if hatred and gossip was murder, if lust was rape, how many of us would be behind bars today? Thank goodness, you know, we don't lock people up for thought processes, right? It'd be pretty empty this morning. But Jesus has this little sticky fact that he kind of, you know, keeps throwing out there, and that is that in God's mind, demeaning other people, calling them names, gossiping about them, slandering them, is hatred. And hatred and lust, it's just like murder and rape. And Jesus says they rack up the same kind of debt with God. What kind of bill have you and I rung up with God? Jesus tried to teach the first century Jews that he was a part, you know, of that culture there. He wasn't just talking about the future and talking about philosophical, religious things. He actually tried to teach them to get along with their Roman oppressors. He knew what was coming if they couldn't get along with them. So, go the second mile, turn the other cheek, that kind of stuff. But they didn't take his advice. They decided to choose the way of rebellion and violence against Rome instead of forgiveness. And now the Romans, once the Jews rebelled, you can hear them back there in Italy, can't you? We're a red-blooded Roman. I'm a red-blooded Roman, and I'm not going to take this. And so they responded by making very efficient war against Israel and the Jews. They marched in very methodically, stamped out each little rebellious group, made their way, finally constricted that around Jerusalem, laid siege to Jerusalem, broke down the walls, took the stones of the temple, pushed them off the Temple Mount. They still lie there as rubble. The heat from the fire when they burned the temple was so hot, it said it melted all the gold, all the precious metals that were in the temple, and they ran onto the ground. There was one last little group of rebels who had taken over one of Herod's stronghold mountaintops, Masada. An impressive piece of landscape. And they had sequestered themselves right up there on top of that mountain. And so that was the last place the Roman army went after Jerusalem. And they circled that. And if you're on Masada today, you can look out and you can see the 4 forts that were built, 4 corners, all the way around the mountain. They built these 4 big fortresses first. And then they built walls between the fortresses to enclose the mountain. They made it a city. And then they built this gigantic siege ramp that went right up to the edge of the gate to the wall of the fortress of Masada. And the rebels that were in there, who had murdered a lot of Romans to get there, that's how they took control of the city in the first place. They snuck in one night and gave them all the knife, saw that the knife was all that they had left at that point. And so before the Romans broke through the walls, They cut the throats of their wives and their children. And then they cast lots and they took turns killing each other. And then there was kind of a last guy left there. He was supposed to drink poison, except he didn't. And that's how we know the story when it comes down to it. To not forgive is suicide. And this unforgiving, vengeance-seeking, dead-end way of life can take hold of your soul. Your mind becomes a weapon. You live with that weapon so long, and any moment you can whip it out on somebody, any person at any time, and you can do terrible, creative, unimaginable things to other human beings. How does God bring about the transformation of our minds, what we so long for? The murderer Saul became the apostle Paul. How does a person change like that? If you notice, Jesus begins this sermon here in Matthew 18 saying that we'll never enter the kingdom of God unless we become like little children. We all need to remember that we were once nobodies. Nobodies who, because of the grace of God, became somebodies. Jesus said that those who are forgiven much, they will love much. And you know what the opposite of that is, don't you? If you feel like you've been forgiven little, you'll forgive little. So what all went into your $4.5 billion debt? You know, the one we're all still adding to. I want to show you a photograph here. Tell you a little bit about these two guys. This is Innocent and Gaspard. Innocent is on the left. He's wearing the white shirt here. And he has a very ironic name because he murdered five people. He executed five people standing in this spot where he is right now. And one of those people was Gaspard, his brother, the one who's standing on the right. Now, like many people in Rwanda, there have been so many murders, so much conflict between them that they found that the only way we can unravel this is to use forgiveness. And so they got really serious about forgiveness. And these two men participated in a process that took literally years together. They worked together in the fields. They studied forgiveness and reconciliation. They prayed with each other. Now, Innocent spent several years in prison. And when he got out, he confessed everything to Gaspard. And he asked Gaspard for forgiveness. And today, they count each other as friends. Isn't that an amazing story? Yeah. Now, just look at their arms. There are words there. As they stood there to take that photograph that day, they wanted to write something on their arms, so they wrote these words: "Love is the weapon that destroys all evil." Love is the weapon that destroys all evil. Is forgiveness just for people in Rwanda? Or maybe in South Africa? Is it for us as well? Is it for our country? Is it for our city? Is it for the street that you live on? Is it for the school that you go to? Is it for the business that you go to work at? Is it only for people without nuclear weapons? Only for the people who realize that they're not as strong or stronger than everybody else? Is forgiveness a sign of weakness? Is forgiveness a last resort? Have we forgotten that our mind is a weapon of mass destruction too? How many times have you heard over the past week or the past years, and I'm sure it's been going on as long as there are bad things that happen, "I want revenge because I'm a red-blooded," whatever, right? This past Last week it was, I'm a red-blooded American. I'm sure when it's another war, it's I'm a red-blooded whoever. It's like, I have this urge within me that I cannot contain, and I have every right to let it out. And that's just the way I feel, and it's my right. Around the world, it's the very same story. Do people not, you know, when that realize that when they're crying out for vengeance, they're using the oldest rationalization known to human beings. It came out of the mouth of the first murderer, Cain, and his caveman great-grandson made a song out of it. He just put a tune to it. That song has been sung. What's at stake if we don't forgive? And I mean us. What's at stake if God's people, the ones who say they are followers of Christ, do not forgive? What's at stake if we don't learn to give up for vengeance and make peace with other people? I know that there are Christians out there who will tell you that God doesn't give a care about this world and that Jesus is just the escape hatch from it. And that's just not the way the first followers of Jesus heard him. Because they heard him pray. He taught them to pray, "Kingdom come, kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And those first followers of Christ, when they're presented with the man, Saul, who was in charge of wiping out that movement, who comes to them and says, "I've changed," somehow they can forgive him. I imagine there were people forgiving him there who had lost husbands and wives and children, right? To this man. And they forgave him freely. And the church becomes the one who Paul learned to love. And it was the one he died for. Jesus came to turn the logic of revenge upside down. In the kingdom of God, vengeance as a way of life is even now, at this moment, being replaced with the unlimited forgiveness of Jesus. If people could know us, if people could know you, and that was the very first thing that came to their mind, that is a forgiving person. There is unlimited forgiveness that person hands out. If you, like Kare and Esther, had a picture on your wall that represented ultimate forgiveness for you on this earth, what would it be? If people could come over to your house and could see that about you, how do you think the world would recognize us then? How do you think the world would change? I know this. I want to live in a world marked by the forgiveness of Jesus. That's the world I want to have. Is that the world we have? Do you want to live in that world? How much do you want to live in that world that forgiveness might make? As children of God, the debts that people owe us remind us of the debt that we owe God. It's like we float on a boat in a deep lake of grace. And the grace is, we can't see the bottom of it. And it's clear all the way to its depths. It's pure. And that's, we rest in that boat floating on that lake. And when somebody asks us, or we see somebody that needs grace, and we want to take a thimbleful and pass it out, or a dropper and give you a little bit of this on your tongue, how can we rationalize that? We better have a bucket ready, right? We should be splashing and playing in that water. There's so much to share, so much to give. It's limitless. So, you know, the other point of this story is what kind of God can forgive the unforgivable in human beings, that can forgive that $4.5 billion debt and say, that won't even touch my checkbook? Right? I won't even see that on my bank account. Sure, I forgive. That's who we follow. That's where we rest. That's the boat we travel in. May we be worthy of it. Let's stand and sing.